Welcome back to Leads to Scale, a podcast about building businesses and scaling ideas. I am your host, Toby Daniels. On this week's episode, we have international speaker, best-selling author, and host of the Hive podcast, Natalie Nahai. During our conversation, we discussed her 2013 book, Webs of Influence, The Psychology of Online Persuasion, and we looked specifically at what has changed in the 4 years between the first and second edition of her book, which was recently republished. We also talked about her current work researching the psychology of social media influencers and how the insights she gained from this research can help to guide marketers as they think about how consumer engagement needs to evolve in the future. We also spent some time digging into our recently announced 2020 global theme, Human X, and what being human first and experience driven in marketing means to her. I know you're going to love this conversation. Natalie is such a breath of fresh air and brings such a nuanced perspective to her work and is clearly very passionate about the fundamentals of why we engage in the way that we do. As always, thanks for listening. And please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Leads to Scale on your favorite podcasting app. Have a great day and enjoy the conversation. On the podcast today, we are joined by Natalie Nahai, international speaker, best-selling author, and host of her own podcast, The Hive Podcast, and also Seeking the Self. Welcome, Natalie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Toby. It's a pleasure to be chatting with you.
I'm so excited to be talking to you. We've known each other for a long time, but it has been a little bit of time since we last spoke, so lots to catch up on. So hopefully our audience will sort of forgive this being a, you know, 2 to 3 hour long podcast because it's definitely been a few years. So for our audience's benefit, so you've written several books, including The Webs of Influence, The Psychology of Online Persuasion. You contribute to numerous national publications, including the BBC and CNN, specifically focusing on the impact of technology on our lives. You also speak internationally. You've actually also spoken at Social Media Week. And specifically, you sort of focus on helping people to identify opportunities to apply behavioral science principles to enhance their websites and web experiences, including like blogs and content marketing and audience experiences and things like that. So for our listeners, what I'd love for you to do, Natalie, is share a little bit of insight into kind of your specialism. I mean, I've covered a lot of ground there, but like, what is it that you specifically focus on? And give our listeners a little bit more background on you.
Sure, well, that's a really nice introduction, thanks. Specifically, my intention is to synthesize information and research insights from various different fields to enable us to understand more fully the spectrum of online behaviors, how they get influenced, and the intersection between persuasive technology, online behavior, and ethics. So I see my role mostly as someone who reads the research, who synthesizes it, and then hopefully communicates it in a way that's going to be useful and accessible to most of us so that we're able to take the insights and apply them in our own lives in order to create a better, more mutually beneficial web.
And you know, it's been a really interesting journey for you, and it's been wonderful following that journey, getting to know you, consuming the amazing content that you put out into the world. But take us back a little bit, like, you know, where did it all start? Like, what put you on this path, and in many ways, how did you get to where you are today?
Oh, wow. So I did a psych degree. I then went to art school in London, Central St Martins. I then left. I was in music, recording and performing for about 5 years and decided it would be good to learn how to code and design websites, mostly for myself. So I ended up learning Dreamweaver and a bit of HTML and CSS and all that, and ended up going into freelance website work. And then was looking for a job, got encouraged not to go into an agency life, but more to look at what might be possible if I was going to create my own career, and then came across the idea of synthesizing the psychology that I'd read years ago, which was fascinating but largely inaccessible because of all of the jargon, and look at how it might be applied to online behaviours, because we know that physical environments shape our physical behaviours out there in the ordinary world, so there must be some research around how virtual environments do something comparable. And this is back in 2010, and I couldn't find anything. You know, UX wasn't even a thing yet. Behavioral science was still being researched, but not widely written about. And I couldn't find what I was looking for. And so in 2011, I decided to research and write a book that I would find interesting. It was quite naive, I think. I thought it'd be quite easy. I was going to swear there. I'm not going to swear. Am I allowed to swear on this show?
Oh, yeah, it's encouraged.
Okay, sure. Well, it was a bit of a head fuck. It was extremely difficult. And because also when you're doing these things, you know, I have a tendency to want to be as rigorous as possible so that people have robust breadcrumbs to follow if they want to dive into the research, because research is constantly updating and evolving. So you have to understand what the base is and where it's going in order to get insights that are going to be useful further down the line. So basically I wrote the book, it got published by Pearson, and that's kind of what got me started on the teaching, the speaking, the workshops, etc. That's quite a lot of information.
Let's talk about the book. No, it's great. But let's talk about the book for a second, because it's sort of interesting when you read the title, Webs of Influence, you think, oh, well, that's just obviously something that's been written in the last like couple of years. But we're talking like 2010, 2011, is that right?
Yeah, so I researched the first edition in 2011 and it came out 2012. And then the most recent edition came out 2017, yeah.
Well, let's talk about that. So when you looked to refresh and update and come out with a second edition, what had changed? Like what just unpack the book in its kind of original format for us, but also then talk about what changed over the first and second edition. Cause I'm sure that you had to kind of just add in a ton more stuff given the amount of change and disruption that's happened in the sort of the web and world of social media since.
Yeah. Well, I say I've massively underestimated the work that would be involved in writing a second edition. In both editions, it's structured in three parts. So part one is to know who you're targeting. So that's to understand the psychological context of your audience, of your prospective customers. So looking at decision-making, cultural quirks, which is fascinating, individual differences, which looks at personality. Part two is about communicating more persuasively. So looking at the basic principles of persuasion, optimization of websites, images, psychology of colour, which is so poorly represented in books because there's actually very little conclusive research that is universal. So that one was a really complex chapter to research and to write. Then social media and customer service, which in the first book was much more about teaching people about what the platforms were, how they worked, which of course now is very old school. So now it's more about the dynamics that you can apply across any new social platform. It touches also on videos. That's part two, about communicating persuasively. Part three is about selling with integrity, because we often leave out of the conversation the importance of ethics, of the role of doing these things with integrity and for mutual benefit. So I talk about influence, like the background of what it is, where it comes from, principles of online persuasion, and then how to apply some of these things for mutual benefit to increase sales, looking at pricing and value, and also behavior chains. So, yeah, it's quite rich, it's quite dense, but hopefully very fun and applicable. And I think in the second edition, what I found really exciting to research was the whole section on personality, because by the time the first book had come out, about six to eight months later, a lot of the preliminary psychometric research that was being done at Cambridge, which then actually got used by Cambridge Analytica and all these other companies, that started coming out. That type of research started coming out. And so in the second edition, I go into much more detail as to what the research says, how to use these principles in non-invasive ways. There's a lot of updating that needed to be done.
And one of the reasons I was particularly excited to talk with you today is to learn a little bit more about the research you've been doing on the psychology of social media influencers, and specifically their sort of authenticity styles. Because, of course, much of what you're talking about in terms of the focus on updating the book and also this specific research aligns really nicely with our 2020 theme, which is Human X. The future of marketing will be human first and experience driven. So can you just talk about the work you've been doing, looking specifically at the psychology of social media influencers?
Sure. So there's several places that we could start. I think most interestingly, if we start talking about authenticity in general, one of the difficulties when we're dealing with social media influencing as a way of marketing to people is the fact that there's actually often a lot of ambiguity between the message that's being conveyed by the influencer and the amount that's being conveyed via the influencer by the person, brand, etc. that they're partnered with. So authenticity is obviously key, and when you look at the research, you tend to find that a person or brand that's perceived as authentic, their message is going to be more readily received. It's going to enhance the perceived quality of the content of what they're saying, so the story, and it also increases openness to engagement. So a lot of this points towards the importance of transparency and also being consistent and coherent with one's values. So if you're going to partner with a company, it makes sense to partner with a company whose values are shared by the influencer, because the influencer in turn is attracting an audience who also shares their values. So when you look at the underlying principle behind this kind of liking, attract like, so it's a sort of a tendency to associate and bond with similar others. This principle is called homophily. And when you dig into the research, you find that a homophilous or similar source, so an influencer in this case, or a brand, is generally more likely to be perceived as credible and trustworthy and reliable, and the effectiveness of what they're communicating is going to be greater. So if you can find ways, whether you're a brand or an influencer, to connect with people along shared common interests, shared values, shared lifestyles, then you're much more likely to get a resonant message across that they're going to respond to.
It's just fascinating. I help me sort of just unpack it a little bit more, or the other alternative ways in which you're kind of looking at this.
Okay, so we can also talk about there's so many. Should I just go on my little trip, and I can take you through things like familiarity and novelty, and then authority styles and authenticity styles.
I'm packed and ready to go. Let's do it.
Okay, please stop me if it's too much content at once. Okay, so before we got on the recording bit of this call, we were talking about how humans, as complex and rich as we are, often have internally competing needs. So one of these needs is our desire for novelty and our desire for familiarity. So on the side of novelty, we're sensation-seeking beings. We like being stimulated, we like excitement, we like newness. Some of us have a much greater appetite for this than others, but broadly speaking, most people have some sense of appetite for the novel. At the same time, we have a desire for safety, for familiarity, for being able to rest in a secure environment where everything is predictable. Now, of course, these two things come into tension with one another, and we see this tension played out online in the kinds of content that we tend to consume. So if we're thinking about familiar content, these are pieces of content or perspectives that are considered homogenous. So they confirm our existing views, we experience them as being quite comforting, they might reinforce our existing perspectives and encourage stasis. So these are things that are aligned with our values already, that we don't have to think too hard about as to whether we agree with them or not. So I love reading The Guardian. I can happily read The Guardian and not have my views challenged because I'm fairly aligned with their perspective. That's a homogenous source. So that's homophily, love of the same, expressed in my pursuit of that particular content. Now that's the familiar side.
I had you down as a Daily Mail reader, actually. So that's shocking to hear that you're a Guardian reader, but go on.
Newsflash. So here's the interesting thing, right? So if I'm someone who reads either one or the other, it can be really helpful to seek out content which is, quote unquote, kind of on the other side of the fence, if we're going to be binary about it, although of course life is rarely binary. So if I'm seeking out stuff which is novel, I'm going to be seeking out heterogeneous content. So this is stuff that's going to challenge my views, maybe some of the views espoused by the male, for instance. It's going to make me uncomfortable. It might offer me alternative perspectives that I hadn't considered. And it's likely to encourage growth. So this is content that challenges us in a way that we're able to maintain enough attention to be moved by it. So it could be, for instance, Colin Kaepernick's Nike then picked him up, his kneeling to express solidarity against racial injustice. So things like this, that it's going to challenge some people, and that's going to be helpful because it encourages a new perspective. And yet many other people are going to be aligned with that particular action because their values are shared. So these are kind of elements of what we look for in the content that we consume. I'm not used to speaking so much without asking questions. This is most bizarre.
No, it's good. I mean, it's the thing is that I'm trying to think about this through both the lens of consumption and through the lens of content creation, right? So a lot of our listeners are, you know, digital marketers who are thinking about kind of content strategy. And the key thing is that, you know, much of what you're talking about and the insights that you're sharing is like enormously helpful as we sort of think about the types of content to put out into the world, what people consume and why. And I'm just curious, like, because you are talking about it so much from the consumer's perspective, how much of your work and how much of this thinking specifically has also taken into consideration, you know, how to approach and think about this strategically as an actual content marketer?
Yeah, I mean, I think because I'm so fascinated by context and how that then informs the decisions that we make in content and marketing, etc. I think one aspect that's increasingly coming into play is the consideration of the social identity of the people that we're trying to reach. So social identity theory basically looks at how we tend to view ourselves as belonging to a group of similar individuals and will then base part of our personal identity on membership to that group. And then if we feel that we're part of a group, so it could be I'm conservative, I'm more liberal, or whatever it might be, I'm a climate activist, then we're going to value the opinions of those group members more than people outside of those groups. So I think when we're thinking about creating content specifically for an audience, and many marketers, I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with this idea already, we have to figure out how to wisely segment audiences based on what we think their priorities are going to be in terms of their identity, in terms of their values, whatever goals, emotional and practical, they might be that they're trying to achieve. And then you can start to play with how to create content. So, for instance, I'll give the example from earlier, the Colin Kaepernick example, when Nike took that risk, they knew that they were going to alienate a vast population of people that were previously their customers. But they also know, based on a lot of the research, that people who are younger tend generally to support protests along the lines of being against racial injustice, against LGBTQ injustice, against gender injustice. Younger people are much more invested in these social themes as a cohort. I am making a generalization here, but so if they're looking to bring in and create content for customers that are potentially going to have a longer lifespan as a customer because they're younger, then it makes sense for them to understand the social identity of the group and then align themselves with people who are influencers who will help create content specifically targeting this group's identity, values, and sense of what should be going on in the world, if that makes sense.
It does. And I think what's also really important here is to understand that we individually carry multiple social identities. Context, as you say, matters because, of course, my social identity in terms of like how I represent myself on Reddit is fundamentally different to my social identity in terms of how I represent myself on Facebook or Instagram or any one of the other platforms. Can you talk to that in terms of like how your work is informing kind of like that idea? But also, I guess even more importantly, what we need to be thinking about, again, from a sort of the sort of strategic standpoint in terms of how do we cater to all of these different social identities?
So if we talk about context, which you've so keenly observed, we do bring different aspects of ourselves into different contexts. So the Toby that goes home to meet with his family at Christmas is going to have a different flavour to the Toby that shows up at work, a different flavour to the Toby that's the husband or the dad, or who shows up on Reddit, for instance. So we bring different aspects into different contexts. And so one of the good things that we can do is to look at the context as a platform. So if we're thinking about the social channel that we're going to be creating content for, what are some of the primary reasons for people using that platform? What do they principally go there to consume, to create, to share? What's most of their attention and interaction targeting? Is it to do with, for instance, on Instagram, is it mostly to do with how good something looks, which of course it's going to be because it's content first, visual content first. On Reddit, it may be a completely different element that comes to the fore. On Twitter, it's generally more text-based or information-based. And so that creates one lens of context through which to understand people. And then also understanding what it is that people hope to achieve in those different contexts. So in the book, I remember there was a whole section that I researched around pricing strategies and how if you have a much more emotional connection with the thing that you're buying, you're less likely to be as price sensitive. And the same thing could be said on, well, a similar thing could be said on different channels. So if I'm going to research information, the content you might create or the information you might choose to give may be structured differently to that on that you might create on a platform where the interaction is going to be more for inherently pleasing purposes. So I'm going to go there to get a hedonic kick. I'm going to go there to feel pleasure or to be seduced by a beautiful image. So I think that context is also incredibly important.
We interrupt this week's episode of Leads to Scale to share an update in regards to our forthcoming conference in London, the 10th annual edition of Social Media Week London, Europe's premier conference for media and marketing professionals, is taking place at the QE2 Conference Center in Westminster between October 31st and November 1st. This year's event will continue the 2019 global theme Stories with Great Influence Comes Great Responsibility, a conversation that will explore how social media has become the most influential story platform in the world, that has the power to both unite and divide us. Check out our first wave of speakers and secure your pass by visiting socialmediaweek.org/London. And don't forget to use the code LEADS2SCALE at the checkout to save an additional 10% off your pass. All right, let's get back to the show. So go back to our theme for next year just for a second, because there's an aspect to it that I'd love your thoughts on. So, when we talk about being human first in our approach to marketing, it really is about a sort of an effort to prioritize the needs of human beings above all other potential priorities. And what experience-driven means is taking into consideration the holistic experience, social media, the internet, the fact that we represent ourselves from a social identity perspective in so many different ways through different contexts, means that it's kind of messy and fractured and fragmented. And when you're thinking about how do we enrich people, how do we provide value, how do we engage them where they are, we have to take a more sort of holistic experience sort of driven approach to things. And I'll put you on the spot a little bit, but like, what, because of course this is just like how we think about it, but I'm curious, when you hear human first and experience driven, what does it mean to you?
Well, I think one of the things I've been thinking about a lot recently is the fact that when we say human first, experience driven, we often forget that many of us, the majority I would say, not all of us, are designing with a two-dimensional interface in mind. So we're talking about screens. And what I think is really interesting is that when you raise this idea of human first, well, what does it mean to be human? I know we're diving into an existential question here, but I've been contemplating this quite a bit. And when you think about, for instance, I'm going to digress a little bit here to illustrate a point, but when you think about embedded technologies, so touchscreen technologies in cars, for instance, and we go, okay, well, we want to make sure that the user experience is really good, We need to make sure that it's fluent, that it feels easy to use, frictionless, and we pile all these words on. And we forget that we're only designing for one of our senses, our visual sense, which actually may not be the optimal way to be designing for that specific context and situation. So in this example of touchscreens, you know, and embedded screens are becoming ever more present in our daily life, we have to consider whether that specific approach, that specific application of technology is actually creating the most efficient, optimized experience for the goal. So the goal, presumably, in that instance, might be for the human in the car to be driving more safely, to be having a better driven experience to the benefit of other humans around them. So if we're talking human first, we're talking about not just that driver, but a bunch of other people with whom they will hopefully not crash. And so in that instance, we have to expand our definition of what it means when we're talking about a human first experience. We have to expand the context in order to bring in other senses to the mix. So I remember, I wonder if you remember this, we're similar age, so you may. Do you remember when we had like tape Walkmans and you could feel like the little forward and back and play buttons?
Do I remember that? Oh, I mean, yeah, It was yesterday, of course. I mean, I very much right. A child of the 80s, so yeah, it was brought up on that technology for sure.
Okay, so me too. And so I remember sitting in, I don't know, car journeys with my parents, I don't know, on holidays and stuff, and it would be dark, but I would know exactly where push forward and back was and where the play button was. And that was because it was a physical knowledge of how to interact with my environment, which I learned. So it was optimized for ease in the sense that I didn't have to whip out a torch and try and find it. And of course, after that, maybe many of us would be familiar with the first phones, like the Nokia phones or whatever, where you've got a physically raised touchpad so you can type without looking, like all of these technologies. And now you find that we've optimized away from physical interaction, from a three-dimensional space. And this is a good example, like with the iPhone, the new iPhone that's just come out, or actually the iOS software. You don't even have to tap your phone anymore. You slide your fingers. So you're not even moving through air, through three-dimensional physical space to interact with your device. You're just sliding us back to two dimensions. So if you're in a car and you're trying to navigate, the most optimal user experience is not actually going to be a touchscreen with nested navigation where you have to take your eyes off the road and look at the screen in order to get to what you want to be doing. And in fact, I think it was Mazda that has stopped using touchscreens in their cars, principally because it's not optimized for the entire human. It's not optimized for the best driving experience. And so I think when we think about designing for the human, we have to think about not only the whole being, so not just the visual sense, but how else can we use, might be augmented reality, it might be physical cues to create an experience which is much richer, but also much less effortful. How do we optimize for the multiple senses? And also then how do we optimize for our wider sense of what it is to be human? So in connection with other beings, more than humans as well, so our environment and the beings that we share this world with.
What's also interesting is that, you know, we're a sort of a, I don't know whether you want to call it an inflection point, but it's a very interesting time in the world of marketing in the sense that I think there's a sort of a general coming to Jesus moment where we're sort of discovering that we've spent a huge amount of time obsessing about and focusing on entirely the wrong things, and we've sort of like almost lost our way as marketers. And part of the reason for that is data and metrics have forced us to kind of chase things that are not helpful in regards to creating incredible experiences or providing value to consumers, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and I think also together with that, we also have built technology and have designed algorithms to optimize, and by optimize I mean, you know, churn out the lowest cost content to drive down the cost of something, cost of acquisition or cost of conversion or engagement or whatever it might be, and oftentimes the content itself isn't particularly like enriching or good for us or positive in nature or necessarily even true. And you know, there is a way back from all of this, and I think a lot of your work informs kind of the direction that we need to go. But I'm just kind of curious to hear your thoughts in terms of how important that is for you when you think about your work and you think about the value that you can create and how much you can help to put us back on a path towards creating better experiences and enriching, you know, consumers' lives and creating as much value as possible.
God, that's such a good question. I think a lot of it comes down to, well, a few things. One is reaching into a sense of what it is, you know, what is it that I'm missing in this experience? When I go onto this platform or I interact with this brand or I read this article or I consume this content or this video, what's missing? And I'm not saying that every piece of content or article or video has to be this enriching, life-changing piece that addresses our deepest existential questions. I'm not saying that at all, but I think that there needs to be a redressing of the balance between our desire for quantitative measures of success, which of course is extremely seductive. We all like to get lots of activity and likes and the rest of it because it's that external validation that we're being interacted with, that we're being valued on some surface level. But we also need to bring that into balance with our deep desire for recognition and for meaningful involvement with the people that we share our lives with, the brands that we choose to buy from, etc. And so I think it's interesting when you think of it from the content side, because there's various different ways that one can look at this. I think from the content side, it means maybe just reducing the amount that we're putting out there and increasing the quality. And maybe that means doing a piece less often, but creating something which is going to be more nuanced, more subtle, more rich, more complex, or more beautiful, or more distilled even. We can go for simplicity and make sure that we're distilling it to the point at which it is most concise, but then no further. So we can look at it from the perspective of content. And of course, I mentioned values earlier, but that's something which younger people are missing and being much more vocal about wanting more of. And then you can also look at it from the perspective of the platforms that we're disseminating and publishing our content through. So for instance, I don't know if you read about this earlier in September, Facebook decided that it might start testing whether it should begin hiding public-facing like counts. So if you're a brand and suddenly the people who are reading your content can't see how many likes your post already has, then if they respond to that post, it's not going to be because of social proof, because they've seen that 10,000 people have liked it. It's going to be because they're actually probably more genuinely interested in the post itself. And as a consumer, as a person on the other side of that, you're not going to get wary of and tired of the social proof element and thinking, well, am I just a person that's one in a number? You're probably going to think, well, this is much more relevant personally to me. And so maybe then I'll just interact with it more freely than I otherwise might, because my likes are not going to be public or visible, at least in the way that they were previously. So I think those two elements are really important to consider, how we change things from the content side and also how we create a more valuable and respectful experience from the quantitative side, from the Facebook and Instagram and Twitter side of things.
I love this. And what one of our sort of sub-themes is looking at the what we call the attention revolution, but really sort of coming from what is essentially an attention crisis that we're sort of like living through and experiencing right now. And part of that attention crisis exists because there is a wealth of information. And there has been, generally speaking, a lack of consideration about the importance of people's time and people's attention and how much ultimately we value it. There's a quote by Herbert A. Simon, which I love in this context, which is a wealth of information creates a poverty of attention and a need to allocate that attention efficiently among the overabundance of information sources that might consume it. And you know, I just, as you talk about thinking about like content and how do we revisit the creation of content, or what we put out into the world as storytellers and as content creators and as publishers, brands, marketers, etc., we have to come back to this idea that we have what is essentially, and I don't want to kind of like overplay this, but I believe we have a moral obligation towards having a much deeper and a much more profound respect for people's time and attention. And that, for me, is where we have to start. And when you think about, you know, the sort of the vanity metrics and things like likes and what they are designed to achieve in terms of manipulating behavior, they certainly have not been designed from the perspective of having a deep obligation towards people's time and attention. I think that's just so important. I think also what's going to be important in the future is the amount at which the amount that we invest in curation. And I don't mean algorithmic AI driven curation, which, you know, will always be a component part, but just the importance of human curation. And thinking about how do we design systems, but built around the idea that human curation has to be a factor and has to play a role. And we cannot completely cede control to the machines, because it's just never going to end well. Would you agree with a few of those different sentiments?
Yeah, I would say that they're extremely astute observations, and I love that you're talking in terms of responsibility and accountability and this sense of having some kind of moral compass and choosing how we want to move forward. I'm also thinking that as you're speaking, I remember thinking back to when I first met you at one of the social media weeks in London, this is years ago, and the excitement and buzz that's there at the beginning of any new wave of technology, and how thrilling it is to be on the cusp of something that's going to be big. And now I find myself, I'm sure this is part of the natural aging process, but now I find myself having more of these types of conversations with people with whom I kind of started in similar places. And a lot of people are talking about this, and that gives me a sense of hope that now that we've kind of been through a few cycles, we've seen it grow into a certain direction. Many of us who were there in the earlier stages in its infancy and were talking about the ways in which this could go are having these conversations and saying, okay, well, what does it actually mean if we continue down this path? What are the ways in which we've gained and lost certain things that we might want to change the balance of? And I think spaces like this, where you can bring people in conversation, to be able to direct the technology that we have and the way that we use it in a way that will serve humanity to, and this again, this comes down to one's values. I mean, I'd love to live in a world in which humanity strives to be compassionate and in greater balance with the resources that we have, with the natural environment, with one another. And so in that instance, how can we drive and design for that? And what would that look like, both from the kind of a meta vision to something much more tangible? I really love what you're saying.
Well, I mean, it's interesting when you talk about compassion. I mean, we one of our second sub-themes, and this isn't just an opportunity for us just to continually plug our 2020 theme, but, you know, I've spent a huge amount of time in the last, like, 6 months with an industry group that we formed earlier this year called the 404, which is looking at sort of how do we address some of the problems that exist as a product of how we use social media. And one of the areas that we've been looking very closely at is empathy. And once we started to dig into empathy and understanding what are some of the reasons why we act and behave less empathetically online and in social media, we've sort of discovered that there is just like a much bigger, much broader set of societal issues that exist. So social media is a component part of it, but it's not to blame. There are just some extraordinarily important and worrying kind of forces at play. You know, the fact that we kind of push our kids through childhood and adolescence so quickly now, with an idea that like they must compete, they must succeed, they must win at all costs, puts just such an incredible amount of pressure on people, and it forces people to just, you know, operate and exist with a much more individualistic mindset. The reason why we have like the reason why there is a rise of narcissism and a reduction in empathy is because of, you know, some of these factors and forces. And of course, social media represents an opportunity to look at everybody else and what they're doing and how they're doing and who's doing well or living their best lives. and the truth is that it's not real. You know, in the context of the broader, wider, non-social media human experience. And so the decline of empathy, I think, is one of the most worrying things that we have to think about and do something about, because it's particularly problematic among, you know, very young people who are onboarding or on-ramping to social media for the first time. And sorry, go on. I think it sounds like
you want to
jump in.
You should. Go ahead.
All I was going to say was just that, in combination with all of that, you know, we are also fairly sort of optimistic that there's a role for brands and businesses to play here, because we believe that empathy can be good for business, and that may sound like a hell of a kind of leap to try and make, but when you look at the Colin Kaepernick example and you think about Nike and the fact that they took a risk, they leaned into a social cause and conversation that they didn't necessarily have to, but they felt it was necessary because they wanted the community and the communities that Colin represent to understand that Nike sees them and understands and is empathetic towards their struggle. And I think that's just so powerful to think about. And it's powerful to think about, I think, more importantly, because it's not just about it being good for business, which clearly when you look at Nike's just like recent earnings report, it really is good for business. But it's also, again, coming back to it's coming back to what I was saying earlier, it's their moral obligation. This isn't a choice that they necessarily have to make. This is something that they are morally required to do, and other businesses and brands have to recognize that, because it's the difference between greenwashing or jumping on a cause and, you know, and having a really robust CSR strategy and actually genuinely making a difference in the world.
And I think it's possibly a combination of motivations that go into that. So on the one hand, people getting into positions of authority within these companies and taking that opportunity to create positive change in the world. And I do think that has something to do with a richer diversity of cultural identities, sexual identities, gender identities, you know, the places in which people are born. Like, we're getting a much better, more representative representation of different lives in higher positions of power. I think there's a lot more that could be done to help make that even more robust. But I think that also changes the ways in which people internally in companies experience what a life looks like, instead of having maybe a narrower understanding of what people experience. Having suddenly a much richer, broader understanding makes a difference to how they make their decisions to reach out to people. And I think also there may be some sense of just plain kind of commercial interest, as you say. So for instance, you know, if these big organizations have smaller companies snapping at their heels because they are values driven and they are appealing to a younger demographic, then they have to pivot. And the only way to pivot, if they're going to do it in any meaningful way, is going to be to actually take a risky stand where they do seem to have something to lose. And I think that when you look at brands like Nike, or for instance, one of my favorite brands, Patagonia, the activist brand, that's really campaigning for regeneration of our climate and protection of certain tracts of the environment in specific campaigns, you know, there's a reason that these brands are doing so well. And I think that's because there's a real hunger for that. And I think in relationship to your point earlier about narcissism and social media reflecting and exacerbating aspects that we already experience as a human, as human qualities. So our desire to be seen, our desire to be liked, to be perceived in a certain way, those narcissistic elements when it kind of goes to extreme, that our desire for that too also leads to its sort of its shadow or another aspect, which is also our sense of isolation. And if we're constantly comparing ourselves to these impossible standards of a perfect life in which people are living their best life, they're never in conflict, never in tension with themselves or anyone else, then of course it's going to leave us feeling quite hollow and potentially disconnected. And that connects back to this sense of meaninglessness and our desire for meaning, which everyone pretty much has in some way or another. And so I think if we can tap into that, we could potentially use this point of crisis and chaos as an extraordinary opportunity to really reshape our world in a way that's going to increase our experience of what's possible and live rich lives alongside one another without having to kind of try and homogenize or divide and the rest of it. That's my hope anyway.
Well, I mean, everyone, including us at the individual human level, and I believe also at the kind of business and brand level, needs like a good existential crisis from time to time. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because I think that that's what's happening right now. There's a moment we're in where we're having to kind of search within and look deeply within ourselves to kind of like understand, well, what the fuck do I stand for? Like, what's important to me?
Yeah.
And how are my values, how am I expressing my values, and how are my values represented by the people I surround myself, the brands that I align myself with, or the products that I consume? And that's just a really good thing. But you can't, existential crises don't exist without like some hardship and some deconstruction of like, you know, social and moral norms. It seems that existential crises don't happen without us also first electing really like terrible people in positions of power, because I also sort of believe that like that's probably going to be an important kind of input into the crisis, because it's going to help us really understand who we really are and ultimately who do we really want to be and what do we want to sort of stand for. So coming out of the crisis, I think we will be in a probably much better place. But it's going to be really painful as we sort of, you know, go through that experience. Which is probably a great place to wrap the conversation, not because we don't have more to talk about, because I knew that this would be a conversation that would have the potential to go on for much, much longer. But
we'll need another installment to talk authenticity styles.
Exactly. But Natalie, I really appreciate you and your work, and I think you bring just such a fascinating perspective to these types of conversations. So sincerely, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure talking with you and hearing your thoughts.
Thank you for listening to Leads to Scale, a podcast from Social Media Week. Leads to Scale is edited and produced by Al Manarino. For the latest news and insights, or to learn more information about how to get involved with future Social Media Week events, please visit socialmediaweek.org.